You could win recordings of all 10 Making the Case conferences and recordings of more than 50 hymns featuring the Lutheran Public Radio Choir. Here's how. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. with Apple Podcasts. Copy and paste the text of your review and send it to talkback@issuesetc.org. We'll announce the winners on February 1st. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. with Apple Podcasts and send your review to talkback@issuesetc.org.
The Gospel of John speaks of Jesus as the light of the world, the divine one who comes into the world to rescue the human race from sin and darkness, and says if you believe in him, you can be saved, you can have everlasting life. If you don't believe in him, you go to everlasting death. The Gospel of Thomas, on the other hand, speaks of Jesus as the divine light that comes from heaven, but says, and you too have access to that divine source within yourself, even apart from Jesus.
That is religious historian Elaine Pagels, author of the Gnostic Gospels, talking a little bit about the Gospel of John versus the Gospel of Thomas. Now, it's an ancient document. There are no two ways about it. Elaine Pagels didn't come up with the Gospel of Thomas. It dates back to, the 3rd or 4th century. So it is an ancient document. And it does have the form of a gospel, and it was actually in circulation. We know that the ancient Christians were aware of its existence. Why is it important to study something like the Gospel of Thomas when we studied the ancient manuscripts of the canonical gospels? And what were the Jewish gospels? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's part two of our series on the New Testament manuscripts. Today, the Jewish Gospels and the Gospel of Thomas. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. He's Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and the Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University. He's author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, What We Can Learn from the Oldest Texts. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
What are the Jewish Gospels?
Well, the Jewish Gospels are referenced many times by church fathers in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries and beyond. But, you know, we don't actually have the manuscripts. We don't have copies. We haven't found something in a coffin or in a cave or something like that preserved from antiquity. We just have these references and some quotations. And what makes it confusing is that they're given various names. So we hear expression Gospel of the Hebrews, or Gospel of the Nazarenes, or Gospel of the Ebionites, which probably means the poor ones from a Hebrew word. And then we even have a reference to a New Testament manuscript called the Judaicon, which has different readings in it. But the trouble is, we don't actually have those manuscripts. So scholars today are unsure, was it really just one that went under different names, or did we have more than one, maybe two or something? We're not sure. We're not even sure what the language was. They'll say written in Hebrew or written in Aramaic, and we're not always sure which language the ancients have in mind, because sometimes Aramaic and Hebrew as words describing the Jewish language, almost interchangeable. So that's what they are. That's what we have. And so Papias himself in the early 2nd century says Matthew wrote his gospel in the Hebrew dialect, and people translated it as best they could. So anyway, that could be related to it. The scholars discuss it. It's fascinating. And so what I do in my book is simply say, okay, we're not real sure how many of these were out there. They date to the early 2nd century, more than likely. So let's just look at the quotations and interpret them and see if we can make sense of them. And it's very instructive because this is a reflection of Jewish Christians. They have still a high regard for the law, a high regard for John the Baptist also, and their take on Jesus is a little bit different sometimes. And so the church fathers quote those passages in the Jewish Gospels that are a little bit different. They don't condemn them, but they're a little uneasy with the presentation sometimes.
Why is Matthew, the canonical Matthew, identified as the most Jewish of the four canonical Gospels?
Well, it emphasizes how Jesus fulfills the law, for one thing. That's very clear in the Sermon on the Mount. It cites five or so examples of how Jesus' expectations for believers to live up to the standards of the law exceed even the scribes and the Pharisees. It cites scriptures fulfilled right and left. Jesus is seen, like Moses, up on the mountain teaching several times. There are five major discourses probably meant to mimic the five books of Moses. And so when you get those kinds of things, you know, when Jesus completed his teaching, then he did something. I mean, that's a phrase taken right out of the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses in the Old Testament. So Jesus is portrayed in some ways like a new Moses who gives the law again, interprets the law again. And most scholars think it's because Matthew is saying to a skeptical synagogue, you know what, Jesus really is the fulfillment of both the law and the prophets. He really is the Messiah. He really is Israel's Savior. And the synagogue is skeptical because the synagogue is saying, well, you know, Rome still dominates the world. Why isn't the Messiah here sitting on a throne and making the Gentiles subservient to him and to Israel? So that's why we think Matthew is the most Jewish. I mean, John is too, but Matthew seems to be the most Jewish of the Gospels. And we think these so-called Jewish Gospels that the Church Fathers talk about very likely are different editions or versions of Matthew itself.
So tell us a little bit more about those non-canonical Jewish Gospels. What do we find there where scholars looking at these patristic quotations of these documents say, well, that's not quite Matthew, but it sounds like Matthew?
Yeah, you get a slight tweaking, a little bit of lowering of Christology. It's like there's a bit of an unease with seeing Jesus in an absolute divine sense. You can talk about him as God's son, but that doesn't make him God, doesn't make him divine exactly. You see an exaltation of the law, a reluctance to see the law as perhaps superseded. You get a little bit of asceticism emphasized. Like one of the Jewish Gospels, John the Baptist doesn't, you know, it says like in our canonical gospel tradition, you know, he ate locusts and honey. Well, in one of the Jewish Gospels, he's a total vegetarian, so he won't eat the locusts. You know, the honey's okay, but he doesn't, you know, and so you just see this tweaking, and you don't, like I said, the Church Fathers don't condemn these Gospels, they just find them a little bit curious. And oftentimes it's in the context of a commentary. They'll be talking about, well, Jesus taught this, and he said this, and this is what it means. Oh, by the way, in one of the Jewish Gospels, Ebionites, you know, Hebrews, Nazarenes, whatever, it'll say it actually reads a little differently, and they'll cite it. And so we're trying to infer from these quotations what the documents as a whole talked about. And I'll tell you, Todd, we have to be careful, because if what we have are quotations of everywhere it's different, that you know, we could make a mistake and assume that the Gospels are very, very different, when in fact 90% of the time they're the same and read just like it reads in Matthew. So we have to be careful that we don't infer too much from such a small sample.
Then what do we know about the non-Greek language versions of Matthew's gospel? There are quite a number of them, aren't there?
We actually have a medieval text. The author is called Shem Tov, which just means the good name. It's a kind of an honorary title for the fellow. There are some other names as well. But here's what's interesting. We have a Hebrew version of Matthew, and of course his whole purpose isn't to be nice at all. He quotes Matthew line by line, comments on it negatively. He's trying to argue in the early Middle Ages that, hey, listen, Jews in synagogues, don't listen to the Christians, don't listen to their gospel. Let me show you what's wrong with it. And so he provides a Hebrew translation of the Gospel of Matthew, and then verse by verse, paragraph by paragraph, as he works his way through it, faults it and shows how it doesn't always have things right. Well, what's really interesting about it, the reason I talk about it, is because it doesn't seem to be based on the Byzantine Greek text that was the dominant New Testament text of the Middle Ages. It clearly seems to be based on a much earlier Greek text, and that's what makes it so fascinating. And so it's well worth reviewing Shem Tov's Hebrew text and asking ourselves, you know, is he accessing an earlier form of the Greek that's actually closer to our earlier Greek manuscripts that we now have, that we didn't have in the Middle Ages. We didn't have until really the 19th and 20th centuries. So it's a fascinating text. It's worth looking at. In fact, one of the texts I visited when I was in Oxford is called, it's the Greek New Testament Papyrus number 19. It's just a single leaf, and when you look at it, front side, back side, you have the last part of Matthew chapter 10, the first part of Matthew chapter 11. And in a couple of places, it actually agrees with the way Shem Tov's Hebrew text reads. And so, that's a pretty early attestation. And of course, Papyrus 19 is 3rd century. And so it suggests that Shem Tov isn't just, a careless Hebrew translation of the Greek, but actually is based on a very early pre-medieval text of the Greek Matthew. So to me, it's all fascinating when we look at the evidence that survives from antiquity and try to understand it. We realize the text is very well preserved and people are talking about it. People who are Christians, but also people who are not Christians who find it interesting and want to talk about it.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. It's part two of our series on the New Testament manuscripts. We will turn to the Gospel of Thomas right after this. You could win recordings of all 10 Making the Case conferences and recordings of more than 50 hymns featuring the Lutheran Public Radio Choir. Here's how. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. with Apple Podcasts. Copy and paste the text of your review and send it to talkback@issuesetc.org. We'll announce the winners on February 1st. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. with Apple Podcasts and send your review to talkback@issuesetc.org.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive word and sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide word and sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Listen to the best of the Church's music for the Epiphany season at lutheranpublicradio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's part two of our series on the New Testament manuscript. Today, we're talking about the Jewish Gospels and turning to the Gospel of Thomas. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. Dr. Evans, introduce us to the Gospel of Thomas, and why is this Gospel not included among the canonical Gospels?
That's a great question, because you read in some of the popular literature, even scholarly literature today, it's almost like, hey, there's a conspiracy. Why did we keep Thomas out of the New Testament? Has a different take on Jesus. Why couldn't it be included? There's actually the Jesus Seminar guys from California came up with a new edition of the New Testament that contains it. Well, here's the weird thing about it. Number one, the Gospel of Thomas starts off by saying these are the secret words of the living Jesus, which Thomas wrote down. Well, if you know anything about the New Testament canon and the church, early church's attitude, secret things weren't part of the canon. the canon was made up of the writings that can be read in public. Well, Thomas does not want to be read in public. So whoever wrote it wants, this is secret, it's only for the elite group of people. It's only for small numbers, privileged, elite, spiritually insightful type people. It isn't to be read publicly for everyone to hear in a church gathering. So right away that shows us that the whole question about Thomas being in the canon is misguided from the outset. Thomas doesn't want to be a canonical work. In a sense, it's a commentary that takes the reader to a deeper meaning. It presupposes that people know about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the public gospels. But it's going to now take you into a deeper world of the secret teaching of Jesus. So that's right away what's funny about it. And the other thing, too, is the actual artifacts. As I point out in my book, yes, we have a complete Coptic translation of the original Gospel of Thomas, and that's 4th, maybe early 5th century. But we have three papyrus, fragmentary papyri, that add up to about 22% of the whole. And that's from a little bit earlier time. It's from the 3rd century. And so the artifacts themselves make it clear that these were not publicly read. There's a difference. A publicly read text, the writing is a bit larger. There are indications, a little bit of word division sometimes, and other markers like paragraphs and so on, as aids for the reader. So when the reader stands up to read, it's just a little easier to read the text. Well, this is small, cramped hand. In one of them, it's written on the back of another document. These texts were not designed to be publicly read. And so papyrologists have noted that. So right away, that's another strike. So if Thomas saw itself as canonical or trying to be canonical, why is it read then or written out in a way not to be read in public? Why is it claiming to be secret? And so those are two strikes against it right away. And the other thing, too, that this is where I think some scholars have gone astray, all of the evidence suggests that Thomas was written well into the 2nd century. It reflects ideas that were talked about in Syria in the second half of the 2nd century, even shows acquaintance with Tatian's Harmony of the Four Gospels, which was written in the around 170 or so. So I think by the time somebody compiled Thomas, the issue of the four gospels was settled. Everybody knew there are four gospels out there. It's just being written as a, like I said before, like a commentary. Here's a new way of seeing Jesus. Let's go a little deeper. Let's see Jesus as an ascetic, as an elitist who has secret teaching to impart to the precious few, as opposed to the general public.
You mentioned several times that it's a self-professed secret document. Is it full-blown Gnosticism? Explain what that is and why it may have an affinity for that heresy.
Well, that's a great question, Todd, because lots of people have talked about Thomas as Gnostic, and it is because it is mysterious, secretive, esoteric. And also, of course, the full Coptic version that we found, the Coptic translation, is, you know, like I said, in late 4th, early 5th century books, leather-bound books, a dozen of these recovered in the area of Nag Hammadi, Egypt, right after World War II. And so if Thomas is included, it's now officially in what we call Codex Number 2 of Nag Hammadi. It's the second tractate, in other words, the second book inside this leather-bound book. And so that gave it the impression a lot of people had, oh, Thomas must be Gnostic. But, you know, not everything in the Nag Hammadi books, not everything is Gnostic. I mean, Plato's Republic, part of it is quoted. And some other wisdom texts are there, you know, sayings of the wise and that kind of thing. Just because you're in this Gnostic collection doesn't mean you're Gnostic. I'm of the opinion, I agree, what I think is the majority view, that Thomas really isn't Gnostic. It's esoteric. It's elitist. It's ascetic. It's strongly vegetarian. It's against sex, for example. It's radically pro-celibacy. You should live as a solitary person. You should not have anything to do with business or money. And so it reflects a certain strain of the Syrian church that was emerging in the second century, late second century. That's where Thomas comes from. So no, it's not Gnostic. Full-blown Gnosticism believes there are two gods, a good god, a bad god. The bad god made the earth. The good god is a god of light above it. And so the goal of Gnosticism is for us to discover that and figure out how to get out of this physical world, how to escape our physical bodies, to ascend up into the heavens where the god of light is. And the evil god doesn't want that to happen. The evil god keeps us imprisoned in this dark, fallen world and in our physical bodies. That's Gnosticism, and no, that's not the Gospel of Thomas.
So you mentioned this before. Its earliest known manuscripts date from the beginning of the 3rd century. Why is that so important when discussing Thomas?
Well, the dates of the manuscripts, of course, help us in dating when the original was written. For me, what is more important than just the dates, you know, we have 3 Greek fragments, the earliest perhaps about around 210, 220, 230, something like that. So as you said, the beginning of the 3rd century, one of them seems to be closer to the middle and one of them seems to be closer to the end. And these are all approximate dates. But for me, what is really significant about the date of Thomas is that nobody knows of it until the 3rd century. The first person that actually refers to it is Hippolytus of Rome, who's sometime writing between 220 and 230. He says, oh yeah, there's this gospel out there called According to Thomas. And then about the same time, maybe a decade later, Origen, and he's in Egypt, Alexandria, he references it. He says, oh yes, he says, the heretics, they've got this gospel, they attribute it to, as they do to various apostles. They've got this one they attribute to Thomas. So I find it really strange that if Thomas was written as early as some scholars have said, as early as the 1st century, how come nobody talks about it, nobody even notices it, or even begins to quote it until the 3rd century? And so it isn't just the fact that our earliest fragments of Thomas don't show up until the 3rd century. That's not that big of a deal. But nobody references it. Nobody quotes it. The Thomas that we have seems to remain unknown until the beginning of the 3rd century. And so that supports, in my view, the idea that it probably was composed only 30, 40, 50 years before that. In other words, no earlier than the 170s or 180s. And you compare that to the New Testament Gospels. They're written in the 1st century, the second half of the 1st century. Well, sure enough, by the time we get to the beginning of the 2nd century, like Papias or Ignatius, the early 2nd century writers, they know of the 4 Gospels and they quote them. You know, in other words, it didn't take 100 years or 150 years before people discovered Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They became known very quickly. Paul himself, in his letter we call 1 Corinthians, he cites the Lord's Supper, the words spoken, the words of institution at the Lord's Supper. It's almost identical, almost word for word, in the version that we have in the Gospel of Luke. And we could cite some other examples where authentic Jesus tradition in Matthew, Mark, and Luke gets echoed or quoted in first century writings and certainly talked about explicitly when we get into the 2nd century. Well, we don't have anything like that with the Gospel of Thomas. If Thomas was written in the 1st century, as some do contend, then he remains a secret for 150 years. How's that explained? And I think the better explanation is Thomas doesn't get written until toward the end of the 2nd century. That's why he's got so much 2nd century Syrian tradition in it. And that's when it's written, and then within 30, 40 years, people are talking about it. And so the parallel with the New Testament Gospels is similar.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. He's Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University, author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, What We Can Learn from the Oldest Texts. When we come back, we'll talk about where the Coptic Gospel of Thomas was found and why it's important.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.
When we talk about children's rights, we are specifically talking about their right to be known and loved by their mother and father.
Some of the assumptions of critical theory not just challenge Christianity, but they're hostile to basic Christian commitments.
Dear Father, would you please teach her what is modest? Would you please teach her what is truly beautiful?
When we get to the second or third centuries and we actually have manuscripts, fragments that have survived, we need not think of them as copies of copies of copies of copies, but they might represent a copy of the original.
Coming up this Friday afternoon, January the 22nd, we'll play Issues Etc., Soundbite of the Week. We've picked out four soundbites from our excellent slate of guests, and we have made them ready for your listening. You can listen in advance on the Talk On Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. You'll also find them in your podcast feed. And the listener with the best vote when we vote for Soundbite of the Week on Friday will get the LPR bundle package, an Ad Crucem Baptism keepsake, and I Have Issues t-shirt, the Issues Etc. pen, bumper sticker, notepad, and tote bag when we play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. It's part two of our series on the New Testament manuscripts. Today we're talking about the Gospel of Thomas with Dr. Craig Evans, author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, What We Can Learn from the Oldest Texts. Where was the Coptic language Gospel of Thomas found, and why is that an important question, Dr. Evans?
Yeah, that is an important question, and there are some scholars who think that maybe Thomas wasn't composed in Syria, because after all, everything that we have found is in Egypt, and the three Greek fragments that we mentioned, all three were found at the city of Oxyrhynchus, where we have recovered 500,000 pages of ancient text, mostly papyrus. And then, of course, in Egypt, not at Oxyrhynchus, but not that far away, at a place called Nag Hammadi, near the Nile River, we found the Coptic translation that we've been talking about. So because we have all these manuscripts, four altogether, relating to Thomas from Egypt, so some people think, well, maybe it was written in Egypt. But I doubt that, because there is all of this tradition that we have. It's very distinctive to Syria. And it doesn't emerge in Syria until the second half of the second century. So that argues, I think, very strongly that Thomas originated in Syria, but quickly migrated around, and it left Syria and went down to Egypt, where eventually it gets translated into Coptic, which is the Egyptian language. I think it was originally written in Greek. Syria at that time was bilingual. They spoke a form of Aramaic that we call Syriac, and they spoke, of course, Greek. And Thomas very likely was written in Greek and migrated from there. And so that's what the evidence points to, and until and unless new evidence comes to light, I think we should see it that way.
Why, then, is it useful to look at the Gospel of Thomas?
Well, it's an important part of understanding how gospel traditions are transmitted, how they're interpreted, how they're translated. So I think it's important for that reason. But also, anybody who's into church history, anybody who wants to understand better the growth of the church in Syria, should look at all Syrian Christian products. And there was great interest in Syria in the Apostle Thomas. It's reflected in their fictional letters between King Abgar and Jesus. Abgar is the king of Edessa in Syria, and he's ill, and he's a real person, and he was ill, and he was removed from office for a period of time, and he came back into office later. And so, no, I don't think he wrote a letter to Jesus, and I don't think Jesus wrote a letter back to him, but he's a real person, and a legend grew up that Jesus wrote him a letter and said, you know, I've got my hands full here in Israel right now. but I will, after my resurrection, I'll send one of my apostles to you. That's the story of Thomas, and Thomas became famous, Thomas and Thaddeus. So there is this very interesting Thomasine apostolic tradition that could well be partly true, partly historical. And Thomas, however it happened, became famous in 2nd century Syria. So we have all kinds of fictional writings that are dedicated to Thomas with Thomas's name. Not just the Gospel of Thomas, but the Book of Thomas, the Contender, the Apocalypse of Thomas, the Acts of Thomas. We've got all sorts of Thomasine literature that emerges, almost all of it in Syria, in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. So anybody who's interested in the early church in Syria wants to read the Gospel of Thomas and these other writings. Sure, they may be fictional, they may be pseudepigraphal in the sense that, you know, Thomas really didn't write them. But nonetheless, they do bear important witness to the kind of thinking and the way Christianity was understood in that part of the world at that time.
Specifically, how, as you mentioned before, how do we know that the author of Thomas is acquainted with the New Testament, at least in part?
Yeah, that's another good question, because advocates for Thomas being early like to reverse the flow and say, well, Thomas was real early and influenced a bunch of New Testament writings. Well, I'm skeptical of that, because then if Thomas is so well known, so influential, that people are alluding to it consciously or unconsciously, then why doesn't anybody ever talk about it? Why do we have to wait till the 3rd century, as I said earlier? So I think it's the other way around. I think it's just more evidence that Thomas is late. This is disputed, but about one half, maybe slightly more than one half of the writings of the New Testament are either quoted or echoed in Thomas. And this is a study I did with a couple of colleagues 25 years ago. We went through the entire Gnostic collection from Nag Hammadi with the idea of trying to see, well, how closely connected are these writings to the New Testament writings? Well, some of them are very closely connected and dependent on the New Testament. Thomas is right at the top. It's just pages and pages of parallels, quotations, allusions, paraphrases, and so on. So Thomas knows anywhere from as few as 13 of the 27 writings of the New Testament to as many as 15. That's disputed. You know, there are two or three, well, we're not sure. But most of it is very obvious. And the other thing that Thomas, it isn't just that Thomas knows the Jesus tradition. You know, some of the advocates for the antiquity of Thomas will say, well, Thomas is independently tapping into the Jesus tradition. No. The author of Thomas has tapped into stuff where Matthew and Luke, for example, have edited the tradition to make it read a little more smoothly. The scholars call that redaction. Well, that Matthean or Lucan redaction also is in Thomas. So this is not early independent stuff that taps into the Jesus tradition before it's written down in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. This is dependent upon Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Paul, and, you know, on it goes, 13, 14, 15 New Testament writings in Thomas. So for me, it just keeps piling up. It's just more evidence that Thomas is late and secondary. And the thing is, to put the shoe on the other foot, as it were, if you insist on trying to read Thomas into the first century, and you deny it, its Syrian provenance, then what you're doing is you're robbing the second century church historian who wants to understand second century Syria. You're robbing that important area of inquiry of a very important text. It's as though you're saying, if I can't date this to Palestine, to the first century, then it doesn't really have any value. That's like Western imperialism that says, you know, if it doesn't have anything to do with the historical Jesus, it really isn't worth anything. So I'm trying to shame scholars who do that, and what I'm asking them rhetorically, are you saying second century Syrian Christianity isn't important? Say, this: why are you doing that? Thomas is a very important text for understanding the second century Syrian church, and it should be interpreted accordingly instead of trying to take it out of its natural context and put it somewhere else.
In particular, with reference to its Christology, compare and contrast Thomas with the canonical Gospels.
Well, that is a real interesting question. I guess I'll give away a secret. It's widely believed, and I think this is a mistake, it is widely believed that the Christology of Thomas is low. Let me explain. High Christology, Jesus is divine. He's the Son of God. His death on the cross forgives sins. This is Orthodox Christology. This is Orthodox soteriology, doctrine of salvation, doctrine of the Christ. And so one of the reasons that I think liberal Christianity today likes Thomas is because they believe that the Christology of Thomas is lower. Thomas is that laconic sage, the wise guy, you know, kind of like Apollonius of Tiana. This, the Jesus Seminar in California loved that. So they lionize the Gospel of Thomas because there's a lower Christology. Jesus is more like a university professor. And he's a little bit cynical, and he's trying to tell everybody, hey, lighten up, don't take things too seriously. Be a bystander, just let people walk on by. It's a very low Christology. I think they're quite mistaken. The opening line of the Gospel of Thomas is, these are the words of the living Jesus. These are the words that the living Jesus spoke, and Judas Thomas wrote down. And if you find out the meaning of these words, you will have life. You will find life. And that's not low Christology at all. I think a very high Christology is presupposed. Calling Jesus the living Jesus is, in fact, to acknowledge his divinity. And I've discovered that by doing a lot of research on how in Coptic Christianity, this fascination with living shows up like the living God regularly. So in my view, Thomas presupposes high Christology. And then, as I said at the beginning of our interview, what Thomas wants to do is simply comment on the public gospels and actually take things deeper, not lower, but presuppose a very high and exalted Christology, and then say, okay, in light of all that, what does Jesus tell us to do? Well, he tells us to be vegetarians. He tells us to be celibate. He tells us instead to avoid commercial interests in business. Don't get absorbed with all the cares of the world, and so on and so forth. So the ethics of Thomas presuppose an exalted Christology. So I think a lot of modern scholarly interpreters have simply got it wrong. Thomas is not a low Christology at all.
What is the Dies Tesseron?
Yeah, you know, the Dies Tesseron was composed by Tatian. Tatian is a second century church father. His conversion came about through the influence of Justin Martyr. And Justin Martyr, very proto-Orthodox. Tatian himself had some strange inclinations, but Justin Martyr kept him in line. And Justin Martyr was originally from Palestine, Aramaic speaking, Greek speaking, but he spent his time in Italy, and that's where he was martyred. And so shortly after his martyrdom, around 160, in the 160s, Tatian returned. We don't know for sure exactly which year, but he returned to his native Syria. He too was bilingual. He was fluent in Greek. He was fluent in Aramaic / Syriac. And one of the criticisms that skeptics of Christianity, one of them that they were raising in the second century, was, you guys have four gospels, and they don't tell the same story. And so what Tatian wanted to do is say, well, actually, they do. And so he took the four Gospels and he blended them together. And so the idea was, it's one Gospel, Dies Tesseron, through four. And that's the name of Dies Tesseron, or Dies Tesseron. One Gospel story told through four texts. And so he wove the four together to show, see, it's a harmonized account. It isn't contradictory like you pagans with your endless contradictory stories. And of course, if you know anything about the Greco-Roman mythology and all of their gods and everything, you know that there are all kinds of competing stories all the time. Is this how he was born? Is this where he came from? Is this what he really is? And almost every god in their pantheon, the top 12 of the Greco-Roman gods, from Zeus right on down, you have a alternate theory. You'll have one, two, three different theories about where they came from. And so Christianity made a lot out of that. Said, you guys can't keep your myth straight. And so some of the pagans came back, said, well, you have four gospels, four accounts of Jesus, and they don't all say the same thing. And so what Tatian wanted to say was, well, actually they do. They don't all cover the same ground, and they do have different emphases. But in reality, it's just one story. And so he created what we call a harmony. He harmonized the four Gospels. And there was a lot of effort in doing that in the second century. And Tatian was very influential in Syria. In fact, for 200 or 300 years, it wasn't clear if the Syrian church was going to have as its gospel the Diatessaron or the four individual Gospels. And finally, they decided to go with the rest of the church and say, no, we'll stick with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four Gospels, instead of the Diatessaron. And so the Diatessaron then fell out of favor, which is why we don't have any complete manuscripts of it today.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. He's author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, What We Can Learn from the Oldest Text. We're talking about the New Testament manuscripts in a series with him. A little more on Gospel of Thomas and how it depicts the relationship between the apostles next. If you appreciate Issues Etc., our 24/7 music and talk stations, and our daily verse-by-verse Bible study, The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
Fornication, that is, sexual intercourse between persons not married to each other, is strictly forbidden by the Scriptures. St. Paul sternly warned the Corinthians, "Do not be deceived. Neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality will inherit the kingdom of God." Thus wrote David Ramirez in his article, "Do Not Be Deceived," in the January issue of the Lutheran Witness, Chaste and Decent Life. To read the entire issue on how to live a chaste and decent life, pick up your copy of the Lutheran Witness today, cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you look at the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Theology for blue collar, white collar, and clerical collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest, distinguished professor of Christian origins and the dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University, author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts. We're talking about the Gospel of Thomas. Dr. Evans, how does the Gospel of Thomas depict the relationships between the apostles?
Oh, yeah. One of the really interesting things about the Gospel of Thomas is apostolic rivalries. And I think, again, this fits its second century complex very much. In sayings 12 and 13, and I should point out there are 114 sayings. There's a prologue plus 114 sayings that make up the Gospel of Thomas. Well, in sayings 12 and 13, you get this a little bit of competition going on. Jesus announces that he's passing on his legacy to his brother James. But when James is no more, it's passed on to Thomas. And so Jesus whispers in Thomas's ear, and we're told he tells him three things. And then the disciples, especially Matthew and Mark, but the other disciples, or Matthew, I should say, Matthew and Peter, they approach Thomas and say, "What did he tell you?" And Thomas says to them, "If I told you one of the things Jesus told me. You would pick up stones to throw them at me, and fire would come out of these stones and burn you up. Like, wow, this is really something. And what I think is going on, and others think this too, is that this is a way of clearing the ground for Thomasine superiority. And so this is a way of saying, look, you guys, Matthew, who wrote Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, and Peter, who's the voice behind the Gospel of Mark, the two most influential Gospels in the West, well, Jesus divulged his greatest teaching to Thomas. So Thomas is the one who now will reveal the deepest teaching of all. What's really interesting, Todd, to go back to the very beginning of the Gospel of Thomas, it starts with, these are the secret words which the living Jesus spoke, and Judas, Thomas, Didymus wrote down. And that's a distinctive Syrian tradition. The Syrian Christians love to call Thomas Judas Thomas, and you'll actually see him called that in the Syriac version of the Gospel of John. But what's this Didymus stuff? Well, in Greek, Didymus means twin. And I think what's going on here, it's a family thing. Jesus passes on the authority after his crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension. He passes on his authority to James, his brother. But after James's martyrdom, it's passed on to Thomas. And who's Thomas? He's also a brother. He's the brother Judas, who's mentioned. He's the twin. And I mean, my goodness, how do you trump that? You know, if Jesus is not on earth, then you want to talk to his twin brother. And so that becomes then a legend. And of course, Gnostics like that too. The Gnostics pick up on that. And they want, you know, that's where they get their special secret teaching that trumps everybody. Who cares what Peter thinks? Who cares what Matthew says? You want to get it from the twin. So that's part of this esoteric tradition as well.
Does Thomas refer to or appear to know about contemporaneous historical events?
You know, Thomas reflects ideology of the second century in Syria, which is what one of the reasons we date it that way. But other than that, there isn't any verisimilitude. Like, for example, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you get descriptions all the time of things that actually were going on. You get reference to people like, you know, the Tetrarch, Herod Antipas, Tetrarch of Galilee. You get reference to Philip, the Tetrarch of Gaulonitis. You get reference to Herod the Great. You get reference to Pontius Pilate, who's the governor. All of these people, you know, the Gospels get it right. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John know who's in office and when. You get reference to Caiaphas, the high priest. You get reference to his father-in-law, Annas, who served as high priest earlier. You get reference to the names of certain villages like Bethany or Emmaus. You get references to places in Jerusalem itself, certain pools, certain this, that, the other thing, the Temple Mount. This is verisimilitude. This shows that these authors know the land. They know the geography and the topography. They know the names of the rulers and the who's who kind of people. You don't get that in Thomas. Thomas is devoid of geographical information, topographical information. There are no casual allusions to people that would say, oh yeah, whoever wrote Thomas knows what he's talking about. Sure, it must be first century. There isn't anything like that. The late Larry Hurtado, by the way, a great New Testament textual critic, he and I were actually talking about this one time, and he said, you know, if all we had was the Gospel of Thomas, would we know Jesus was even Jewish? There is one thing, though, Todd, one place in the Gospel of Thomas where Jesus warns his disciples to be careful because they will end up with no place. And we think that's an allusion to what is said after the Bar Kokhba War that ended in 135. Simon Bar Kokhba, the son of the star, was the leader of the third Jewish revolt, 132 to 135, in the second century, which ended in a disaster. Jerusalem was all but smashed to pieces. It was refounded, given a new name, and the Jewish people were told, you can't live here anymore. I know it's your historic city, but you're banned. They had no place in Jerusalem. And so it is possible we actually do have in one passage in Thomas a reference to a current event, and it's a second century current event, which in my view, again, strengthens the view that Thomas really is a second century gospel, not a first century one.
Finally, some have suggested, as you mentioned, that Thomas should be included in the canon of the New Testament, a new Testament, so to speak. How do you respond to that?
I think that's a very silly suggestion. Thomas, as we said earlier in the interview, all of the evidence suggests Thomas doesn't want to be in the canon. Canon of Scripture, by definition, is these are the writings that are read publicly in church. Well, Thomas announces at the very beginning, it is a secret. These are the secret words of the living Jesus. So that argues against that. And then the actual artifacts that we have close to the original Greek writings, no indication that they were written for public reading. They're written in a small, cramped hand, and in one case written on the back of another document. This isn't the literature. So the actual artifacts that we have that have survived from antiquity point to private study, not public reading. So the idea that we should add Thomas to the New Testament flies in the face of Thomas's own desire and intention. The other thing with this new Testament that's been proposed by, and published actually a few years ago by members of the Jesus Seminar, they include outright Gnostic writings as well, and I find that crazy, because the Gnostic writings presuppose two gods. The Gnostic writings are anti-Semitic. The Gnostic writings don't like Israel, don't like the Jewish people, disparage the Old Testament, disparage the God of the Old Testament, the God of Israel, and instead talks about two gods. Why in the world would you want to add writings like that to the New Testament, as if somehow this is going to open people's eyes and be spiritually refreshing or something like that? I've written a pretty harsh review of this book. It just, to me, it's not clear thinking at all. It's a very poor idea.
Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and the Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University. He's author of the new book, Jesus and the Manuscripts, What We Can Learn from the Oldest Texts. You can purchase this book on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Next time, we'll talk with Dr. Evans about the Gospels of Peter and Judas. Dr. Evans, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Listener email is on the other side of the break, along with the Issues Etc. listener comment line. Our email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and the comment line, 618-223-8382.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we continue our trek through Matthew 24 with the abomination of desolation, the open return, in the clouds, the lesson of the fig tree, and the day no one knows. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.
At Hope Lutheran Church in Sunbury, Ohio, you will find rest for your soul, strength for the day, forgiveness of sins, and hope for the future through Jesus Christ. Because at Hope, you'll hear the Word of God faithfully taught and receive the sacrament faithfully delivered. This is Pastor Ben Meyer inviting you to join us at Hope for Bible class and Sunday school at 9:15 a.m. and the Divine Service at 8 and 10:30 a.m. Find us on the web at hopelutheransunbury.org.
Christological, creedal, confessional. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. guest, Dr. Ben Mays of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Here's what Martin Luther says about the pastoral office. My pastor is practicing the virtue that increases God's kingdom, fills heaven with saints, plunders hell, robs the devil, wards off death, represses sin, preserves peace and unity, and plants all kinds of virtue in the people. In a word, he is making a new world. He builds not a poor temporary house, but an eternal and beautiful paradise in which God himself is glad to dwell. We are calling good men to step up. Come to Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Learn more about studying for the vocation of pastor at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.